In fact, most, if not all, or at least a good part of the great inflations of the world have been caused by government borrowing from banks. During World War II, we got at least $36 billion of inflation by government borrowing from banks. This process of inflation by government borrowing from banks is essentially the same as that by private borrowing. Now, the words used are a little different, but the results are much the same when the U.S. Treasury borrows from banks as when Farmer Brown borrows, or when Jones borrows, or when you or I borrow. One of the main differences between government and private borrowing from banks is that the paper the bank gives, the paper the government gets from the bank, is often called a bond instead of a note. Another difference is that the government gets credit at a lower rate of interest than Brown did, or probably than you do. A third difference is that when the banks extend credit to private persons or corporations, the deal is called a loan. But when the bank extends credit to the government, the transaction is referred to as an investment. Perhaps the greatest difference between private borrowing from banks and government borrowing is that the government often borrows on a much larger scale than all private borrowers put together. This is because of the much greater scale of public borrowing. Therefore, it is usually much more inflationary than private borrowing. Now, when government borrows from banks, the banks give the government, in effect, a deposit slip, much as they give Farmer Brown. The U.S. Treasury then writes checks against those deposits and makes payments for salaries and wages of government employees. It pays members of the armed forces. It pays out money for food, clothing, military equipment, and fuel. It buys almost everything from applesauce to zippers. When the war ended, the government had $25 billion on deposit with the banks, largely created by borrowing from them. The government pays by check. Most of those who receive these checks deposit the proceeds in their own checking account. Farmers put some of the payments they received in their checking accounts. That's why our rural banks today have about five times as much in deposits as they did before the war. Well, we've tried to explain in simple language what causes inflation in our time and in our country. This has been a description of inflation by the process of increasing bank deposit money by borrowing from banks. There are two other types of inflation that I should describe for purposes of comparison. One of the most common types of inflation is that secured by printing excessive quantities of paper money. This was the type of inflation we had during our Civil War. At that time, however, the inflation in the South was much more severe than it was in the North. The great hyperinflation in Germany in the 1920s was also, I believe, the result of printing excessive quantities of paper currency. Now, there are two kinds of paper currency, or perhaps more correctly, I should say that there were two kinds of paper currency. First, there was the kind of paper currency that is essentially title to gold or silver. It is called convertible paper currency because the government or bank that issues it stands ready at any and all times to give gold or silver in exchange for the paper. The other type of paper currency is non-convertible currency, and that's paper which you cannot take to a bank or the treasury and get gold or silver for. Now, most of our paper currency before 1933 was of the convertible type. The issue and maintenance of convertible paper currency is naturally limited by the ability of the issuing institution to get and keep on hand a sufficient supply of gold and silver to meet all demands for the precious metals. For this reason, governments cannot maintain convertibility of their paper currency if they issue excessive amounts of it. Now, our own U.S. paper currency has not been convertible into gold since early in 1933. In this respect, it is similar to the greenbacks of our Civil War or to the continental notes of the Revolutionary time or to the paper marks of Germany in the 1920s. Now, true, our dollar is indirectly related to gold in that the Treasury will sell gold to individuals for paper currency for a few specific purposes. And I think the most important of these are for export, shipment out of the country, and for use in industrial purposes. However, since most of us have no need for gold for export or for industrial uses, our paper currency is, for most of us, inconvertible. Most other countries have a similar type of currency now. It is therefore much more, this currency is therefore much more subject to inflation than was the currency we used before 1933. Now, before leaving this question of what causes inflation, there's one more thing that we should point out. It is that it is possible to have an inflation even when gold and silver coins themselves alone, or in conjunction with a convertible currency, are used as money. For example, there was a worldwide inflation from 1897 to 1910. Prices in the United States went up 50% in those 13 years. What caused this big increase in prices? It was a big increase in the output of gold from Africa, Alaska, and Colorado. 50 years before that time, the output of gold from mines in California caused a worldwide increase in money supplies and a rise in prices. Now, another example of inflation by way of gold and silver occurred a few centuries ago, when the Spaniards conquered the Indians in Central and South America. They found and stole vast quantities of gold and silver. When these metals were carried to Europe and made into coins, they gave the people more buying power. And as a result, prices increased over Europe for a period of many years. Well, now we've explained different methods of inflation. In one process, inflation came through greatly increased supplies of gold and silver. In another process, inflation came through excessive printing of paper currency. In our day and with our country, and with our practice of using bank credit for money, inflation comes through excessive use of bank credit. Both private citizens and our government borrow from banks. Both private citizens and public borrowing from banks contributes toward inflation. So far, we have answered two of the four basic questions about inflation. These questions were, first, what is it, and second, what causes it? The next question is, how does inflation affect us? How does it affect you and me and the other people in this country? We've already discussed some of the effects of inflation, but a more systematic discussion, I think, is needed. Now, inflation has both short-run and long-run effects. The short-run effects of mild inflation are greatly to be desired by farmers, or I should say perhaps are greatly desired by farmers, businessmen, and government officials. The long-run effects of a large inflation is disaster for any people and nation. Let us consider some short-run effects first. Remember that an inflation is an excess of demand over supply. Well, now, any general increase in demand tends to raise prices. In a period of inflation, prices of raw materials rise rapidly. Farm products are priced, are raw materials. During the inflation of 1939 to 48, average prices received by farmers were multiplied by 3. During inflations, prices of manufactured products rise less rapidly than prices of raw materials. Most of the things farmers buy are manufactured products. Therefore, prices of things you buy do not go up as fast as prices of things you sell. From 1939 to 1948, average prices of things you bought were multiplied by 2. To put these same facts another way, the 1939 to 48 inflation raised prices of things farmers sell nearly twice as much as it did prices of things farmers buy. Inflation on a moderate scale always brings prosperity to farmers. In 1939, net farm income from farm operators in the United States was $4.5 billion. During the past 3 years, it has averaged 3 times as much. To be sure, things you buy today cost more than they did before the war, but even after we make an allowance of 70% for the increase in consumer prices, the buying power of farm families today is just about double what it was before the war. Well, with this pleasant experience of inflation in mind, it is no wonder that many farmers are not only unafraid of inflation, but would like to have more of it. Why should farmers become excited about the dangers of inflation? Well, now, one reason that we commonly hear is that, well, we should not have inflation. We should fear inflation because it may be followed by a deflation. Well, it might be. That's something, I think, like saying that we should fear rain because it might be followed by drought. But there are other, I think, more fundamental reasons why we should be concerned about the prospect of inflation. First, inflation destroys the value of several kinds of savings accumulated by farm families. For example, money invested in war savings bonds. The $4 one gets back on maturity will buy considerably less than the three originally invested. In 1940, for example, $15,000 would have bought 75 acres of pretty good Illinois farmland. Instead of buying farmland, some farmers invested that amount in government bonds instead. Now they have $20,000. But this $20,000 will buy only 42 acres of the same quality of land. In a similar way, inflation destroys the value of postal savings and bank deposits and all kinds of bonds and life insurance. This makes it difficult for tenant farmers to accumulate enough savings to purchase a farm home of their own. Let's consider life insurance for a moment. Now, some farmers have been paying good, hard-earned dollars on life insurance policies for many years. The beneficiaries of those policies will receive only one half, possibly or less, of the buying power the farmers paid for. Inflation makes it impossible for a man to provide any real degree of security for his family through life insurance. Here's another thing to think about. Inflation makes for higher interest rates and for larger percentage-wise down payments on the purchase of farmland. This makes it more difficult for the ordinary tenant farmer to buy a home of his own. The land thus tends to drift into the hands of those who are already wealthy. In fact, you have observed, I think, that many well-to-do business and professional men recently have been buying up farmland in your communities. This makes it unavailable to farmers who would like to own as well as to farm it. Now, inflation also complicates and distorts the process of property descent and the distribution of estates. Men often find it desirable to will cash to some heirs and real property to others. Sometimes a wife is granted a lifetime interest before the estate is divided among the children. Thus, several years may elapse from the time a will is made until the estate is settled. During this time, inflation may destroy much of the value of the grants made in fixed dollar amounts. Thus, the real value of the estate would not be distributed in accord with the original intentions. Well, so far we've discussed only the effects of inflation on farmers. Effects on other businessmen, and I say other businessmen purposely because at least half the businessmen in this country are farmers. A mild inflation is stimulating to business activity. It makes opportunities for speculative profits. Rising prices make debts easier to pay. Rising prices create paper inventory profits. Some firms have found that they've had inventory profits that showed up as profits on their income tax return, and they didn't have created a liability there which they were required to pay, even though there was no cash in the till in order to pay it. Prices of commodities tend to rise in a mild inflation faster than wages. This makes labor a good buy and employment is increased. Many people are prosperous. Of course, inflation destroys the value of dollar savings of non-farmers as well as those of farmers. Non-farmers also suffer from loss of insurance policies or loss of their value and the loss of the value of bank deposits. And they also suffer from inequities in the distribution of estates. Now, some groups get no benefit whatever from inflation. Many groups actually suffer severe hardship as a result of even a moderate inflation. Consider the effect of wartime inflation upon workers who have retired or who are eligible to retire on a small pension. Now, they have worked for 20 to 40 years to earn a small pension for their old age. Now, many pension plans provide retirement pay at about one-half of the regular wage rates. Now, I ask you, how much will one-half of a pre-war paycheck buy today? And there are many older folks living on such pensions. Some of them live in every community. Now, there would be a great rise of public indignation if some thief should come along and steal $50 from one of those old couples. But they have been robbed of one half of their small incomes that they worked for and had a right to expect. Who robbed those old folks? It was the citizens of the United States. That's you and that's me. We robbed them, we and our elected representatives in Washington. Now, one of the dangers of a small inflation is that it will grow into a large one. Large inflations have occurred in many countries. We have had two in our own country. The first was during the Revolutionary War. The Continental Congress issued paper money, in convertible paper currency. Second, the government stocks of corn should be sold at prices that will promote a substantial increase in the production of meat, milk, and eggs. Now, direct controls over the uses of some scarce materials are desirable. For example, I could see no objection to prohibiting the use of copper for ornamental purposes. I could not see any objection to the prohibition on the use of stainless steel for decoration of automobiles. There are other types of prohibitions that might be established. I would see no objection to the prohibition of building of unnecessarily elaborate and expensive houses. In fact, I don't know, you might get a pretty good argument that we ought to quit making such things as Cadillacs. Maybe we wouldn't need them in time of war. I don't know about that. But there are some of those things that we could regulate. Well, we do regulate the use of materials at all times. In a certain way, I think the regulation of the use of materials has, in a limited way, has much to recommend it. Now, direct controls over prices do not and cannot control inflation. At best, they can only delay its progress. One possible argument for direct price controls is that it makes it possible for the government to withdraw its supports for higher wages. It makes it politically possible, or at least politically more expedient. Now, even the most ardent supporters of direct price controls admit that in order to be effective, price controls must be accompanied by adequate fiscal policies and credit controls. But the point is that if sound fiscal and credit policies are adopted in the first place, there can be no inflation and no need for price ceilings. Now, to summarize. First, inflation is an excess of demand over supply. It is more buying power than goods. Second, inflation in the 1951 American style is promoted by excessive borrowing from banks. Both private citizens and government create inflation by banks. Third, farmers and other businessmen profit a process. Even moderate inflations destroy the value of savings, life insurance policies, and pensions. Greater inflations interrupt production, destroy the middle classes, and create an unbalanced society, and promote crime, vice, and revolution. Fourth, inflation can be controlled by the adoption of appropriate economic policies. The first step in the control of inflation should be to stop the overly rapid increase in private borrowing from banks. Second, the fiscal operations of the federal government should be carried out on a pay-as-we-go basis. Third, we should encourage and promote a rapid increase in industrial production. Fourth, we should use direct controls over prices, including wages, very sparingly. The procedures that we have recommended for the control of inflation are relatively simple. They do not require endless regimentation, nor an army of thousands for enforcement. Yet these policies, and only these policies, can be effective because only they get at the heart of the problem. It is essential that the public, and especially the leaders of the public, understand and strongly support these policies. That is the reason we have talked with you about them today. Thank you.
Friends, you have been